The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Of what's really going on. So we had to get another data source, and we have inside people. We have now a whistleblower inside the CMS, and we have two whistleblowers within the CDC. And those are being developed right now in order to get this out. So we're looking at 10X. We think we have 50,000 dead Americans, 50,000. So we actually have more deaths due to the vaccine per day than certainly the viral illness. By far, it's basically, in a sense, it's propagandized bioterrorism by injection.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it from Peter McCullough. We've played some sound bites from him on the program before. He's an MD. He teaches, I believe, at Texas A&M University and maybe with Baylor as well. So he's in Texas. And he's sounding the alarm. And of course, in a way, this is not surprising, these numbers, because we've been told all along that the actual complaints, if you can call them that, or just the reports of deaths that the VAERS system, the CDC's system, tracks, it only collects about 10% of them overall. So if it's upwards of 10, 12,000 on the VAERS site, well, it could be as many as 50,000, maybe even higher. 50,000 dead Americans as a result of the vaccine. And then look at the madness. We'll get to some of this as we proceed. The vaccine passports that they're calling for in France. Germany's moving in that direction. Of course, the UK, they're leading the way. Got to get the jab. Never mind the fact that people are dying. They're dying. And there's a lot of people that are lying as well. They're not telling you the truth. They're concealing this. You're listening to Stephen Flurry, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We certainly appreciate you tuning in. We know everyone's busy. We've certainly completed a busy time right here on our headquarters campus, completing our summer educational program just last night with the awards ceremony, and then before that, the always well-received track and field competition out in the bright summer sunshine. Some of us a little bit redder today than we were the day before. So yes, all kinds of activity, all kinds of fun and fellowship last night, and lots of tired and perhaps sad campers, teenagers, leaving for home this morning. I'd like to thank our broadcast partner, CRN Digital Talk Radio. We're on Channel 3 on that particular platform that takes the audio of this program, the live stream, into 11 million homes here in the United States. But if you want to get to the live video presentation, the live video broadcast, we provide that for you exclusively at the trumpet.com website. Just go to the trumpet.com/live. There's no cost, there's no fee, there's no paywall, nothing. You can get to this program at no cost or obligation every single day. Of course, if you can't get to it live, it's 11 a.m. here in Oklahoma. It's 9 a.m. out west, noontime on the East Coast. If you can't get to the live broadcast, just go to that same page on the trumpet.com website, and you can see the podcast that we post generally an hour or two after the live stream. I mentioned that people are dying and that people are lying as well. This is from the Epoch Times a couple weeks ago. One of our listeners sent me this just today. It says, last week, America's frontline doctors, AFLDS, came to speak in Kansas City, Missouri. AFLDS founder, Dr. Simone Gold, brought her message that COVID-19 is nothing to fear and that there are treatments available. There are treatments. It says here, at the start of the pandemic, she was fired after speaking out in support of anti-malaria medication hydroxychloroquine. Now, you might remember that drug. That was something that President Trump actually endorsed. And so as soon as he endorses it, of course, big pharma, big medical, big medicine, they all come out in unison against Donald Trump, the bad orange man. He's the problem. And so here was this drug, and again, I don't want to get into drugs as far as our position on drugs in general, but here's a drug that's far less dangerous than the vaccine, that's for sure. And yet you have the experts saying, no, we can't really recommend hydroxychloroquine. We can't really recommend this. It says here, at the time, President Donald Trump was praising the effectiveness of the drug, but shortly after, the FDA revoked emergency use authorization for it. Now, it says, now, here we are, a year later. Now, recent studies are confirming that low-dose hydroxychloroquine combined with zinc, and then a couple of other things, it actually is a good medication. So says the Epoch Times. And yet at the time, they covered it up. They lied. Then the vaccine comes along and well, we can't trust the vaccine. Not as long as President Trump's in office. Then he leaves. Now it's all vaccine all the time. Everybody's got to be vaccinated. And then if you ask about people who are vaccinated and how that they're still getting COVID-19, well, if you're the propaganda chief at the White House, you just shut it down. You shut it down. This was Jen Psaki last week being asked about those in the White House that have tested positive. Clip 13.
Most are asymptomatic if they are individuals who are vaccinated who get the virus. We are in a different place in terms of the impact of individuals who may have, as you said, breakthrough cases.
So why not just provide the number? Are you trying to hide something?
No, but why do you need to have that information?
Are you trying to hide something? The reporter asked. The breakthrough cases, these are people who get the double jab and the virus breaks through anyway. So a reporter says, well, how many breakthrough cases are in the White House? You've heard about the Texas Democrats traveling to D.C., all of these COVID positives for people that are vaccinated. And then they ask the propaganda chief, how many are in the White House? Well, you don't need that information. Why do you need that information? Well, because you say you're the most transparent administration in history. You know, Barack Obama used to say that, remember? And then they never could gain access to the president. And when he did show up for a press conference, everything carefully staged. Oh, yes. What do you need to know that information for? That particular clip has quite a few views. Quite a few views online. People know, you see. People know they're being lied to. This is from The Spectator over in the UK. The push there to have vaccine passports. Ross Clark writes, I had in mind that it would take 2 to 5 years for a vaccination passport scheme to morph into a Chinese-style social credit system. In fact, it took 2 weeks. 2 weeks. That's all that it takes now in this descent into madness. 15 days to stop the spread. And people were willing. Okay, we'll give you 2 weeks. We'll give you, if we can slow the spread, then this is a good thing. And now look at where we are. I thought it would take 2 to 5 years to go toward a vaccine passport scheme. In fact, it's taken a couple weeks. Says this morning it was reported that the government is planning to introduce a health app in January, which will monitor our shopping, our exercise levels, or intake of fruit and vegetables, and reward us with virtue points, which we can exchange for discounts, free tickets to what kind of event is not clear, and other goodies. So where is this leading? It says here, do we seriously want to be monitored like pieces of an industrial plant? It won't be long, of course, before employers see he's pointing out the direction. Initially it's sold as, well, it's you choose, you decide if you want the app, but now if you get it and you get all these virtue points, then you're gonna get all these perks. You may get into a Premier League game a little bit easier. It says here, it won't be long, of course, before employers start demanding that their employees use the app and to see diet and exercise history before giving someone a job, just as clubs and quite possibly pubs and restaurants will be obliged to check our vaccination status before letting us in. Next, they will find themselves forced to check our our dietary history before selling us a burger and a milkshake. He goes on to talk about how that back when they tried to sell the British public on the CCTV, that's where they have cameras, literally all over the country. The British public, they were told that, well, we need it. If it stops one crime, one bit of crime, if it stops one violent act, it's worth it. We'll have it on video. And Ross Clark says here, yet look at them now, programmed to issue fines systematically for the most minor offenses, like straying into the bus lane for a few yards. I remember this well. I lived in the UK 6 years. You're over there, you're learning how to drive in a foreign country. You stray into the bus lane, the cameras pick it up, and the fine comes in the mail. Simple as that. Stray into the bus lane for a few yards, getting caught in a junction, accidentally dropping a few crumbs as you eat your lunch on a city center bench. It is always the same with surveillance. Give authorities an inch, and mission creep sets in at once. Just give them an inch, and think about where we'll be in 2 weeks, in 4 weeks, in 6 weeks. People are angry. France, of course, they have protests all over the country. I don't know if we have footage of that. There's about 160,000 that came out in the UK. All of these protesters waving. In the case of the UK, you had a cluster of people waving a Donald Trump flag. There they are in Trafalgar Square, squeezed in there. We're tired of it. We don't want vaccines forced upon us. We don't want you taking away our freedoms. Play the one from Paris. Massive crowd in Paris yesterday. There you are. People are angry all over the world, protesting these loss of freedoms, protesting this government intimidation, micromanaging the lives of the lives, even the diets of ordinary citizens. Where is this leading? Peter McCullough, this was in a different interview, but here he is talking about how something's very wrong with the world today. And for those of you that follow this program regularly, well, you'll probably know where I'll go with these clips in just a moment. This is clip one.
I personally think that something has gone very wrong in the world. The whole medical, the bioscientific underpinnings have been broken. We're off our moorings. We're not having evidence-based medicine. We're not seeing reasonable conclusions being made. We're not even seeing regulatory decisions being followed. The vaccines have been offered as an elective offering, and they've been quickly mandated. So we're seeing things off their underpinnings right now. There's something going on in the minds of people. There's almost a worldwide contagion of a neurosis. A neurosis is some type of disordered thinking that's spreading from person to person. That's probably more contagious than the viruses right now.
Disordered thinking spreading from person to person. It's spreading worse than the virus itself. This deranged thinking. Now, what's behind this? You know about Ephesians 2 in verse 2, where it speaks of the devil as being the prince of the power of the air. Revelation 12:9 says that the whole world is deceived. In fact, that passage says that Satan's been cast down to this earth, and he, along with his demon army, they are confined to this earth. Now, here's this distinguished epidemiologist from Texas. I guess he doesn't count. He's got to be blotted out, just like Dr. McCullough. Anybody that speaks out, anyone that takes a different view of the vaccine or the lockdowns or the loss of all these freedoms, these liberties, they come under fire, they come under attack. But as McCullough points out in some of these interviews, there's more and more people speaking out. There's whistleblowers now, even inside the CDC, saying that, look, it's not 6,000 to 10,000 deaths. It's 50,000. 50,000 dead Americans. And you've still got people like Joe Scarborough getting up on his program saying, hey, we've got to pressure people into getting the vaccine. We should take away their job opportunities if they don't do it. This is more contagious than the virus. This kind of, as he said, the contagion of a neurosis. Mentally deranged thinking, reasoning. There's a spirit behind this. It's coming straight from our adversary, the devil. He's going about like a roaring lion, the scriptures say. I can't stop referring to what Victor Davis Hanson mentioned last week in his column, The Descent into Madness. Here again is Peter McCullough from a recent interview, clip two.
And this disordered thinking is, I think, rooted in fear, distrust, rooted in anxiety, and it's spreading all over the world, making individuals come up with the most ridiculous decisions, like not treating the virus early, forcing unsafe vaccines on one another, having vaccines divide the workplace and schools, dividing families, having people wear masks when they're, you know, driving or jogging or swimming. This type of stuff makes no sense. My crystal ball is, I think we're in for about a 3 to 5 year period of turmoil. And I think it's mental turmoil in human beings. The types of things I've seen in the minds of people right now is really alarming.
3 to 5 years of turmoil, and it originates in the mind. So many minds in turmoil, so much deranged thinking, and it is alarming. It should be. It is alarming. The Bible talks about if you speak the truth, you're going to become a prey. You're going to be made a target if you just get up and tell the truth. Donald Trump had a speech Saturday night in Phoenix, and he's there. That's where there's a hotbed of controversy over the election audit. But he's there giving a speech, and as per usual, there's people crammed inside the venue, and there's people lining up on the streets for what seems like miles. Look at this. Look at this fast motion video here. Trump supporters in line. In line. Now contrast this with the fake president. Contrast this with the town hall that he had last week. Nobody shows up. Nobody watches it. Quite unlike a Donald Trump rally. People know, you see. They know people are dying. They know they're being lied to. And Donald Trump is out there exposing the lies to his credit. He's a flawed individual. No one's perfect. No politician is perfect, believe me. None of us are. But he does speak truth. He speaks truth about the election steal. And the propagandists, they don't want to hear it because they know if you talk about it, they certainly know if you investigate it, that they'll be exposed, that the cheating will be exposed. Here's a bit from Trump's rally on Saturday night, clip three.
Remember, I am not the one trying to undermine American democracy. I'm the one trying to save American democracy. I'm trying to save it. Our country is being destroyed by people who have no right to destroy it. People that won an election illegally. People that should not have been elected. They lost in a landslide. Joe Biden and the radical Democrats are wrecking our nation. I don't even believe it's him. I honestly don't believe. I don't think Joe knows where he is, you want to know. I don't think it's him.
That's America under attack right there. That's that Antiochus behind the Biden administration, just like you've heard on this this program. He knows. He knows Joe Biden is just the puppet. He knows Joe Biden is not all there. He knows that America's coming under attack. And he even mentioned that, look, this is beyond socialism. This is communism. Who's talked about communist infiltration into the United States of America for 70, 80 years, going back to Herbert Armstrong's ministry? Who has talked about this? And Mr. Armstrong, you go back to the 1950s. He describes what we're seeing today in detail. I didn't bring all the quotes with me. It's in our booklet. He was right. There's a section in there on the communist infiltration. Donald Trump, he knows. He knows. This is skip ahead to clip five. This is the comment on communism, clip five.
I don't blame a lot of people, but they become weak and they become ineffective and they become frightened. Like it or not, we are becoming a communist country. That's what's happening. That's what's happening. We are beyond socialism. You know, when you have no press, when you have no press that you can talk to, that's how a communist country begins. They have no press.
There's not a free press. Makes me think of Mark Levin's book a while ago, On Freedom of the Press. This is how a communist country begins, when they're right in lockstep with people like Anthony Fauci, with the Biden administration, with Barack Obama. No dissent is allowed. And then they work so hard, as we've seen, to just blot out the political opposition, to blot out Donald Trump, to blot out Peter McCullough, to blot out Dr. Mercola, to blot out God's truth, to blot out even the name of Israel, to blot out America and its institutions, its founding institutions, I should say. I heard a bit of a podcast not that long ago where it was this, I forget his name, he's a Kennedy, he's writing this book on the real Anthony Fauci, and he was just talking for a little bit on big pharma and how many people are paid, how many institutions are drawing funding from other agencies that are controlled by Dr. Fauci. And he said, this is why all the experts and the scientists speak with one voice, this one monolithic voice. They don't dare dissent, because if they do, they're cut off. They lose funding. They're blotted out. And I was just sitting there listening to this, thinking, too, about how politicized all of these government agencies have become, the DOJ, the FBI, the IRS. And then you think about not just big pharma, but big tech, big media, big government. Look at what has happened to the United States of America. And then add to it the madness of the last year and a half. 3 to 5 years of turmoil. That's what Peter McCullough sees looking into his crystal ball. 3 to 5 years. And it starts with a kind of mental derangement. And this is where we're headed. Play clip four from Trump's rally Saturday night.
The radical left, Democrat, Communist Party rigged and stole the election. And we caught them. The time to hold them responsible and fix this broken and corrupt system is not in 2022, where it may be just as corrupt, and if it is, you're not going to win, or in 2024. The time is right now here in Arizona.
It starts right here in Arizona. We've got to fight it now. You don't fight it now, you lose in 2022, you lose in 2024. That's what he's saying. And then he exposed the Democrats, too, and why they're pushing so hard for so-called voting rights. The rights to just have ballots flying in from every direction. Fraudulent ballots, that is. Move ahead to clip seven.
It's no wonder that Joe Biden and the radical Democrats are going absolutely crazy, screaming about voting rights, ranting about democracy. They want democracy and resisting every effort to look into the massive fraud in 2020. Just so you understand, you know, we talk about cancel culture. The biggest thing that they want canceled is they don't want you talking about the election that just took place. It's a scandal, the likes of which we've never had. But the only way you get away with a scandal is if they don't talk about it. They don't want to talk about it.
That's right. They want to blot it out. They want to blot out even the discussion because they don't want it revealed. They don't want it exposed. Well, that one clip I played for you, he talks about how that the time to fight is now. Back up to clip six, one final clip.
The big lie, they call it. You know what's the big lie? The opposite is the big lie. The election was the big lie. If I lost this election, I could handle it pretty easily. When they steal it from you and rig it, that's not easy, and we have to fight. We have no choice. We have to fight.
No choice but to fight, says Donald Trump. And so he presses on. Someone else sent me a comment through email today regarding Mike Lindell and the symposium that he's putting on August 10 to 12, I think it is. He's, of course, focusing on the communist infiltration from abroad through the machines and the software and such. And so the fight continues with precious few, but it does continue. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is The Trumpet Daily. You can email the program if you like. Send us a comment, td@thetrumpet.com. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
At the summer educational program, we had a lecture on how we have to make prayer, our prayer to God, the primary focus in life. And in 1 Samuel 1, there's this beautiful, heartfelt, almost agonizing prayer because Hannah, she is just crying out to God. You probably know some of the story here. Verse 9 of 1 Samuel 1, it says, "So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk, and Eli the priest sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Eternal. And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto the Eternal and wept sore. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your handmaid and remember me, and not forget your handmaid, but will give unto your handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Eternal all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head." She was barren. She couldn't have a child. And so she vowed that if God gave her a son, she would dedicate the life of that lad to the work of God for all the days of his life. My father makes this point in his book, The God Family Vision. You can get to all of our literature at the website, thetrumpet.com, or you can call our operators today and request a free copy of the book. The number's 1-866-930-3024. The quote from the God Family Vision, it says, she understood, Hannah understood what she had to do with that son. In the years that God made her wait, she had learned that. How many people, even in God's church, understand that as deeply as they should? Child rearing should start long before the child is born. Wow, that's quite a statement. This is something that you've got to prepare for. I mean, this is a message that runs right through nearly every course that this college has to offer, Armstrong College, or even the education at the lower levels, the academy, that we've got to prepare. We've got to prepare for marriage. We've got to prepare for baptism. We've got to prepare for family. We've got to prepare for children. This is, this is our career, after all. It's so easy to just get swept into the thinking that the career is just the job that I want out working for some employer somewhere, some company. But marriage and family is a career. And nobody's on their deathbed, by the way, saying, you know, wow, I wish I just could have put in a few more hours at work. Or I wish I could have just... When they're on their deathbed, they're thinking about the career that is marriage, family, being together with their loved ones. And if they have regrets on the deathbed, it's often that I wish I would have devoted more preparation and time and energy to family affairs, to my children. Child rearing should start long before the child is born. In that sense, parents must first understand why God gives children. Hannah learned that. It says, by the time her son came on the scene, she was ready to dedicate him to God. She was ready before the child came. That's another statement, quite a statement. Parents need to understand why God gives children in the first place. I asked the teenagers yesterday, why are you here? Why did God give you to your parents? What is his purpose? What does he intend for you? These are questions you would think more people in this world would consider. They would just stop everything and consider it for a moment. Why children? Why does God give children? Well, as this example brings out, it's so that they might be dedicated to God. That they might devote their lives to God. That they might serve in the work of God. It's so that those children might be brought up in the nurture and the admonition of the eternal, as Paul said in Ephesians 6. They need education and training. They need vision. They need to understand why they're here. Well, in verse 20 of this same chapter, it says that Hannah conceives and bears a son who's named Samuel. And then notice verse 24, it says, and when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with three bullocks and one ephah of flour and a bottle of wine and brought him unto the house of the Eternal in Shiloh. And the child, it says, was young. The child was young. And as I was telling the campers yesterday, it's amazing in these first three chapters of 1 Samuel just how often God inspired something like that to be written. You know, this was the child was young. This was a child. Here was a child doing the service to God. Here's a child delivering this message to Eli. A child. You think our young people can use the excuse that they're too young to establish a relationship with God? That they're too young to devote time to prayer and Bible study? I told them yesterday, as you go away, go home and get to know your Bible. Study your Bible and talk to God like this child did. In chapter 2, you have this another beautiful prayer offered up by Hannah. She's quite a woman, quite a lady. And here she's praying, I'll just give you part of it, 1 Samuel 2 and verse 6. The Eternal kills and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and brings up. The Eternal makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and lifts up. He raises up the poor out of the dust and lifts up the beggar from the dunghill to set them among princes and to make them inherit the throne of glory. It says, for the pillars of the earth are the Eternal's, and he has set the world upon them. This is what Hannah saw for this little boy, this little child, that he was going to be stepping into a position of power, a position of rule at God's headquarters temple. Now, that's a woman that had some vision. As my father says in the book, this is what Hannah saw. She saw that she could have a son, and God would make him a first fruit pillar, and God would resurrect him to set the whole world upon his shoulders. And so over and again, we told the teenagers at this summer educational program that they were born to rule, that they were born to be kings and priests. What other group of teenagers on earth hears a message like that? Only at God's summer educational program. It's an educational program for sure. There's all kinds of fun activities as well, like the track and field games yesterday. But what an education! What an opportunity! So it says here in verse 11, and Elkanah went to Ramah, to his house, and the child did minister unto the Eternal before Eli the priest. It says in verse 12, now the sons of Eli were sons of Belial. They knew not the Eternal. So what a contrast. Here are young people, Samuel, who ministered unto the Eternal before Eli the priest. And then Eli's own sons, they were sons of corruption. They were bringing all kinds of perversions into God's house. They were discouraging the people of Israel from worshiping God the right way. What a stark contrast between Samuel the prophet and these sons of Belial. Verse 17, it says, wherefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Eternal, for men abhorred the offering of the Eternal. They didn't want to have anything to do with worshiping God because there was so much perversion in the house of God, so much lawlessness. It says, but Samuel ministered before the Eternal, being a child, girded with a linen ephod. He ministered before the Eternal. As I was telling the young people yesterday, look, we've all been called to minister. That word ministered means to serve. And this is, as Jesus explained in Matthew 20, this is what ministers in the church are called to do, to serve. You can look at that word for minister. It's used in different ways. Obviously, there's offices in the church, those who are ministers, but the word is used in other ways too, more generally, to just minister unto Eli, unto the Eternal. This is from Lang's commentary. The service of the priests and Levites, yes, it can be referred to, or rather used in that way, but also, this is about the term minister, but also it refers to any service, as that of Joshua to Moses, that of Elisha to Elijah, and that of angels in heaven. Angels in heaven, they're oftentimes called messengers, so they're just delivering messages for God. They're ministering unto the Eternal. This is God's way. This is the principle of living that runs right through the family of God. Psalm 103:21 says, bless you the Eternal, all you his hosts, you ministers of his, plural, that do his pleasure. If you're doing God's pleasure, if you're serving God in your day-to-day living, you're ministering unto God. We all have a certain amount of rule. The proverb talks about ruling your own spirit well first. That's where it begins. We've got to rule ourselves. And then 1 Corinthians 11 lays out the organization and structure that there is in family living. Ephesians 5, of course, does that too. But God wants us to learn how to lead. I mean, even leaving aside the church for a moment and the calling that God's given us and how the vision that Hannah saw right into the kingdom of God, but just leaving that aside, every single one of these teenagers that we worked with, 105 of them over the past 3 weeks, in just a few short years, they're going to be a husband, a wife, a mother, a father. I talked with one young man yesterday at the track meet. We were reminiscing about the summer educational program called PYC back then. But the camp, the summer camp in 1999, 22 years ago. And he mentioned how many memorable things happened and messages that he still remembers that still impact him today. And now that father has, well, he's got 3 or 4 kids, and his 12-year-old was at this camp. So we're into the second generation of young people, campers, that have attended God's camp. We're all called to serve, to minister. Verse 21, it says, "And the Eternal visited Hannah so that she conceived and bare 3 sons and 2 daughters." So she had lots of children now. She was barren. Now she's got 6 children. And the Bible draws attention to Samuel in this same verse. It says, "And the child Samuel grew before the Eternal." He grew before the Eternal. Now, that's not necessarily talking about physical growth. I mean, there was that too. There is for every young man. But he grew before the Eternal. In other words, his relationship with God grew. It strengthened his understanding of God's word, God's truth. It grew over the course of his youthful years. This is just a child, keep in mind. Here's what Lang's commentary says. "Samuel's growth before the Eternal indicates not only that he remained in the sanctuary, but also that as a condition of his calling, he grew in fellowship of heart and life with God." Think about that. Heart and life with God. He brought God right into the middle of all that he did. And that's why God blessed him so much. God always does that with us. If we bring him into the heart of what we're doing, if we bring him into our hearts, then there will be blessings and prosperity. There will be productivity and growth. God is always growing. Samuel grew before the Eternal. He grew up. This is the way to grow up. In the world, you just basically think about growing stronger or bigger physically. And yet, like Herbert Armstrong said in The Missing Dimension in Sex, too often there's no corresponding growth with respect to the mental and emotional and spiritual development. That remains stunted. Look at how many adults today behave like little children. They talk like little children. They throw tantrums like little children. Notice verse 26. It says, "And the child Samuel grew on." The child, it says again, the child Samuel grew on and was in favor both with the Eternal and also with men. It says much the same about Jesus Christ in Luke 2, in favor with God and men. And then you think about the 2 great commandments, to love God with all your heart and mind and soul, with everything. And then to love fellow man as yourself. He grew in his obedience to those 2 great commands, those 2 great laws of God. The Hebrew interlinear, it translates the verse this way. "And the child Samuel grew and grew in stature and in favor both with God and with men." So Samuel, he developed and he matured during his childhood, during his teen years. He developed physically, of course, but there's so much more to this. He developed mentally. He developed morally. He became morally upright and disciplined. And of course, he developed spiritually. If you look at that word in the Hebrew for grow on, what does the verse say? And the child Samuel grew on in the Hebrew. It's used frequently to express continuance in the sense of advance or continue. Sometimes it's translated as walk. So you're, in other words, you're going forward. You're making progress. And this is the way it was with Samuel's education. He grew on. He continued to grow. He continued to educate himself. He continued to minister unto the Eternal. He didn't think he was too young to get serious about studying his Bible or serving God. He was a youth. I'm sure he had a lot of fun and played games and laughed and joked. There's balance to godly living. But here's a young teenager, perhaps 13 years of age, when he developed this really mature-minded relationship with God and took the commission that God gave to him, as challenging as it was, and just accepted it. He showed some courage. He showed some fire, some zeal. You don't see a lot of that, certainly not with young people. Today, chapter 3, 1 Samuel 3, 1, it says, "And the child Samuel ministered unto the Eternal before Eli. And the word of the Eternal was precious in those days. There was no open vision." So God first appeared to Samuel. Probably my father writes about this in our literature, but it probably happened when Samuel was about 13 years of age. And this was a dark time for Israel, coming out of the period of the judges, where you had 4 centuries of everyone just doing what seemed right in their own eyes. 4 centuries of a lot of turmoil. 4 centuries of thick darkness with respect to God's truth. And God's solution to this madness, it started with a teenage boy, with a child. Wow. I mean, if you're a young person listening to this message, that should serve as quite a motivation. A teenage boy who just immersed himself into this very royal education, this training that God wanted to give him. Verse 9, it says, "Therefore Eli said to Samuel, go lie down." We're picking it up in the middle. God was speaking to Samuel at night, and Samuel thought it was Eli, so he kept running over to Eli's bed, and Eli said, "I didn't say anything." And I think by the third time, Eli said, "I think God's speaking to you. So next time you hear the voice, address God in heaven." So it says here, "Therefore Eli said to Samuel, go lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you shall say, speak, Lord, for your servant hears. So Samuel went and lay down in his place." Verse 10 says, "And the Eternal came and stood and called as at other times, Samuel, Samuel. And then Samuel answered, speak, for your servant hears." My father in the former prophet's book talks about just how beautiful this attitude is. And how that we need this attitude. When God speaks, we say, "God, I'm listening. What would you have me to do?" That's the attitude that this 13-year-old had. A child who grew on in favor with God and with men. What an example. Verse 19, listen to this here. It says, "And Samuel grew," over and again, you see, God drawing attention to the fact that he was growing and developing as a youth. "Samuel grew, and the Eternal was with him, and did let none of his words fall to the ground." That's why he was growing so much. Because he would not let God's words fall to the ground. He was only a teenager, but he really hungered and thirsted for the word of God. Just like it says we should over in Matthew 5. He was hungry for God's truth. He was hungry for God's righteousness. And this is how God educates a young man whose heart is turned unto his maker. This is how God educates a prophet. You can look at that passage in John chapter 6, speaking of not letting any of the words fall to the ground. There's a verse over in John 6 where Jesus said, when they are filled, he said to his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost. You gather up all of the scraps, gather up all of the fragments. And when they did that, they ended up filling 12 huge baskets of leftovers. And you can see in that study of John 6 how that, again, there's a spiritual lesson that Jesus is making. We don't want to let anything go to waste. As I've told the campers here the last couple of days, you don't want to squander this opportunity. You want to consume every single word that there is. You want to make sure that you're really hungry. When you're hungry physically, you tend to sit down and eat a lot. You want to get a lot of food. How hungry, though, are we spiritually? How much do we hunger for that manna from heaven? How much do we hunger for every fragment, for every word? This is from the former prophet's book. My father says, we are God's remnant church because we didn't let those words drop, but we must keep improving. Or to use the language that says about Samuel, we must grow on. We must grow on. We must continue. We must improve. We must continue developing. My father says, after all, God's going to set the world upon our shoulders. And that's a reference to the prayer of Hannah there in 1 Samuel 2. God's making us pillars. God's training us as kings and priests. So we need this training. We need this education. We need every single word. It says here, God's going to set the world upon our shoulders. I read that. And then it says, we will need every word, every little bit of education that God gives us. I know that in my life, I really need every bit of education that God has given me and still need a lot more. That's coming from our pastor general, who's now into his 80s. And here he was at this camp just last week, talking about how important it was for the young people and for even himself to bring more structure, to bring more organization, to bring more planning into his study of the Bible, into his study of other literature and or history or whatever it might be, to really just have an ambition for learning, to have a hunger and a thirst for righteousness, for God's truth. My father said this, we are the lowly of the world, not the geniuses, so we need to be like Samuel and work to keep from letting God's truth straight from his mind and mouth, drop to the ground. We have to work like Samuel did to prevent any of the truth of God from dropping to the ground. We just want to go out and gather up all the fragments like they did there in John 6, and just fill up the baskets. Just fill up on God's way of life. He says, finally, my father does, Samuel knew what an opportunity he had. Do you? Do you know what kind of an opportunity you have? I asked this of the campers yesterday. But it's something that we all might consider. We need to make it our goal. We need to make it our goal to gather every word just as perfectly as possible to fill up on even the fragments, even the tiniest pieces, to have a real hunger and a thirst for God's truth. You are listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We certainly appreciate you joining us on this first show of the work week. If you'd like to send us some feedback, you can always email at td@thetrumpet.com. We thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.